Thank you. We will now be conducting a question-and-answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star one on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the question queue. You may press star two if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key. Once again, please press star one on your telephone keypad if you'd like to ask a question.
Joe, do we have anybody in the queue? If we don't, I've got a couple questions for Dottie.
At the moment, we have none in queue.
Okay. Dottie, I have a couple questions for
sure.
You.
Sure.
I think that you've brought up so many really good points, and your analogy of smelling like a cigarette ashtray leave me with a picture, but it's perfect. It's perfect.
It worked for me. I haven't smoked in probably 30 years.
Well, and I think it can work for other people. But sometimes, are there certain things you utilize all the time to initiate conversations?
Whoa, that's a tough one because,
and
you know.
And how do you do that? You know,
well,
what type of questions?
Sure. You know, I've often said that we call our patients snowflakes or thumbprints because everyone is so different, so unique. And I guess one of the things is that the first thing I try to figure out is what are we doing today? So even if I'm just meeting someone for the first time, and I know very well what we're doing that day, whether we're having a training or a troubleshooting or whether I've been asked to see the patient for a specific reason. I mean, I know that. And I have access to the medical record and whatever. But in getting started, I like to ask the person what we're doing because then they tell me. And sometimes that helps me zero in on what's in their mind and figuring that out. And the other thing that I often do is see who's there. You know, it is an environment where the person feels comfortable and can talk and can feel that they can express themselves in front of the other people. So it's really something that I do on a one-on-one. Having really looked into now this theory on motivational interviewing, I found it very encouraging for some things that you might say, well, who needs to look at that? But if you look at statistically, you're really able to learn, gee, this is borne out by some hard facts. If we're only going on anecdote, then it's a number of one, you know? And you know, we all do that. Well, I had a patient, this or that, and it's helpful to share. But when you look at a study and it shows that large numbers of people in a control setting, and this was the result, I just find it very affirming that what we do, sometimes by instinct, is also something very proven. It's like our nursing theories, you know, going back to those times. So that's something that I try to do personally, is find out what that individual is going to convey to me and then use the skills that I can bring. And at my ripe old age, after all those years I've been doing this, to be able to draw on some of those experiences over the years, to be able to relate that to situations that I've faced before.
Well, and when you're dealing with your experience, do you find, though, sometimes they come in with a spouse or family member or caretaker, friend. Sometimes it's not the most opportune time. I don't find that they're really going to talk about what we really need to talk about because there is someone else there.
I often find, too, I say that it's like when we come home from the grocery store with three or four heavy bags, what do? We put the heavy one down first. We don't do that when we're in a clinical setting. Well, we may have something really heavy in our hearts or on our minds that we really want to talk with the healthcare provider, but we dibble-dabble with the other stuff and then sometimes don't get to that most important thing. But with a client-centered style, you know, we are trying to get in there at that right moment with the person and be sure that they can express what they came to do or help the person clarify. And if not suitable, then to try to at least set the stage for further discussion. I mean, very often we can't do all the things we'd like to do. We have to prioritize to the couple of things that we can spend time on that day. And that's where I think building the relationship, even if it's just I'll get back to you with information, of being able to sort of sense and then prioritize and go forward in a realistic way, especially if you only have a short time for your visit. And I don't know anyone who practices who doesn't have to watch their time.
No, that's right. Joe, I just want to check again if there are other questions or any questions in the queue at all.
We do have a question from the line of Jennifer Smirko. Please go ahead with your question.
Great.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Dottie.
I should acknowledge your work, too, as a co-chair for these programs. I haven't been aware of how much work it is behind the scenes, so you and Mary have done a tremendous job.
Well, thank you. But I wanted to just say I'm really so intrigued by this discussion because, you know, we oftentimes, I think, don't really get into the descriptive things of what we do. And, you know, as nurses, I think one of the troublesome things that we have or challenges is really kind of documenting what we do. And I think this actually is very tangible and an objective way to kind of clarify that. And I was just curious, in your research for this topic, did you find that there is either a paucity of information out there, or did you find, in fact, that there was a lot of information? And was there, like, any, you know, specific things that you would recommend for those of us who want to do additional kind of research on the topic?
Well, if you've ever bought a red car, and then notice that all you see are red cars on the road after that. That's been my experience with motivational interviewing, because it started, as I said, and as do most of the things that I learn a lot from, start from June Halper, of putting something in front of me that this looks interesting, and then finding, yes, it is very, very interesting. Like just the idea of motivational interviewing being directive and client-centered, where you're eliciting behavior, and how things like the self-help and the change community, how it evolved through that, and yet how relevant it is to the work that we do. But then moving on, you know, to developing within a relationship, et cetera, then making the outline for this and finding that Colleen and Linda had spent work on this of all the multiple resources. And then just in talking in preparation with you folks for doing this, of learning that there's a website, actually, and it's in England, so it's probably related because this first article was published in a British journal. But there's actually a website called motivationalinterviewing.org where there's lots of suggestions and even steps, I understand. And this is not something that I personally have gotten into in depth, but if this is tweaking someone's interest, I mean, it could be just that. And if you're out there listening, I feel like I'm, you know, I'm begging for public radio or something. But anyone who might be out there who says, oh, I'm not asking a question, you know, I work in an office and, you know, this and that, I just wanted to hear what was going on. But if you're just, you know, interested in learning more about working within relationships or how to slow down and convey information, because there's so much information, whether it be information for us, Jen, that, you know, hey, if this tweaks your interest, yes, you can find lots of stuff about it, but also the information for the patients. We are functioning in a time now where, thank goodness, we have lots of treatments and lots of new things and lots of emerging therapies. But if we're confused, can you imagine how people, the patients, are thinking what to do next, et cetera. So a person's not an information receptacle. You can only do so much. But when we put ourselves in that position of thinking of the patient's priority and sending positive messages, and considering the amount of information and when to give it and delivering it with care, it just seems like it makes sense to me. It's the kind of skills that I'm interested in developing better.
I'm sorry. I was going to say I wanted to add about that website that we were talking about, the www.motivationalinterviewing.org, because I did go on there. You know, I was trying to do some additional research for this. And they had a lot of different materials that I think would be very interesting for nurses to actually go in and read about. They had like 10 strategies for evoking change of talk, certain questions to evoke questions, which I thought was very helpful to me because I actually would love to take a course or class, I think, in this. I think this would help me communicate with my patients.
Well, some of the steps for successful informing are, number one, ask permission. You know, the person has to be willing to hear you. I mean, don't you hate it when somebody just starts telling you stuff and not asking, would you like to hear about, you know, would you like to know what other people have done about this? And then offering choices. I really find that one of the biggest contributions I make isn't that what I come up with is so earth-shaking. It's that I come up with options or some choices. You know, to start, like maybe instead of taking your shot at night, take it in the daytime. You know, just to have options. None of us like to just be a fait accompli. You know, we want to have some choices. And then I do find people like to hear about what other people do. Like some people do this or some people do that or, you know, to just to be able to share some vignettes that way. So, yeah, I agree. And then I was hearing about the method, they call it chunk, check, and chunk, like providing a chunk of information. But then you stop and you be sure the person understands
that point.
For you. Yeah.
Now,
then you provide another chunk.
We actually, excuse me, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We do have three questions.
Oh, well, let's get
you
them.
Right now. let's go on. Joe, go ahead.
The next question is from Brenda Moss from San Antonio, Texas. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Brenda Moss from San Antonio, Texas. We were in San Antonio for consortium last year.
Hello.
I'm sorry.
Hello?
Yeah,
sorry.
Hi, Brenda.
Okay,
sorry.
Yeah, sorry, I couldn't hear. No, I was just wondering if you had any cultural differences, if you've noticed that, and if you have a different approach for that.
I personally, yes, I have, and I'm very interested in cultural consciousness and sensitivity and et cetera, because I think that can make or break it. You know, there are some societies where, you know, the man, especially like the father and the head of the household, if he doesn't know something, that would really diminish his standing. So there's, you know, probably one of the things that I learned a long time ago was an expression, say what you mean what you say, just don't say it mean. So so I try to figure out, you know, if I'm involved in a situation that maybe I'm not as familiar with, of a better understanding. And I'll very often ask, you know, how can I make this as easy for you as possible? And see what I get back. But, yeah, I'm very, very aware of language differences, of cultural differences, of trying to be sensitive and put things into perspective.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay,
good question. Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you, Brenda.
Thank you.
So could we check the queue for another question?
Thank you. The next question is from Tony Saldana King from Houston, Texas. Please go ahead with your question.
My goodness, it's a Texas night. Hi, Tony.
Yeah. I was going to say, yes, it's the Texas girls, Tony from Texas.
Yes.
Well, Donnie, thank you so much. I'm glad you talked about this because this is, I really liked the part where you were talking about moving patients to a particular room, because I've noticed when our social worker, she's new to our, if she has patients in the room, the other social worker would have her have the patients come to her room because there was always material laid out. So whether it was intimacy, working or disabilities or modifications to the home or nutrition, that would open up a lot of discussion. And I noticed when some of the patients were in the room, the discussion was closed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that certainly,
yes.
I think you're like right on target about having folks come out, you know, talk, you know, and also Lori asked a good question about having like open-ended questions or,
yes.
Or I guess like for us, we try to make sure that I'll remind my boss, look, the patient called about this or that, or they, you know, are going to get pregnant. And, you know, so that way it kind of puts a special touch to the patient, like, oh, yes, you know, you remember.
Right. And we talked about the chunk, check, chunk, and that's very directive. But what you're talking about, Tony, is the elicit, provide, elicit. So you ask an open-ended question. You focus, you're informing, providing the information.
Right.
And then you ask another open-ended question to determine if the if you're getting a patient response to the information provided.
Okay.
Now, you know, we're talking about ideal circumstances, and I have to laugh because today I had a young woman who is 18 years old, newly diagnosed with her parents, who are beside themselves. With all the decisions coming up on choosing medication, on understanding the disease, and all the emotional feelings, et cetera. So they came in just to see me and spend time with me. So, of course, you know, we have a beautiful clinic. We have this wonderful center. There was no room. I felt like it was another nativity because we were going from place to place looking for room in the inn, and there was no room in the inn. And we wound up going into a room for visual fields and just finding chairs, and the lights weren't that great and whatever. And I had to laugh because here, you know, we think about the ideal circumstances, but then it's the content of that. But asking a teenager to relay in front of her parents, you know, but and remembering to make sure to hear how she felt about it, and not just the parents, et cetera. So yeah, what I've prepared, even just to do this conversation tonight, I think will be very, very useful as a skill going forward.
No, I definitely think so too, and I thank you for the time for taking to do this.
Well, thank you for the time to listen to this. Because what our patients do is hard. You know, we know that. I mean, I've never given myself a shot.
Yeah.
I mean, I can talk up a good story, but I can't give myself eye drops.
Right. I mean,
close my eyes.
And you know, when you're talking about cultural differences, I mean, for us and also like age difference, we also see we have some patients that transition from the pediatric clinic to the adult clinic.
Yes.
And it's I've had to kind of sit in and listen, and they have the pediatrician come over and that nurse come over, and they transition to us. And it's a really big ordeal because we have the doctor in there and then myself. And so it's kind of like, you know, the passing of the torch. And I didn't realize you don't just get the patient, you get the patient and the family.
Oh, boy. Yeah. Well, we don't come individually either. Look at us, even whether it's even just our professional network for IOMSN. You know, we are individuals, but as a unit, and we have so much more strength in numbers.
Yes, true.
And we all go through those times where, you know, it's difficult and we need to be re-energized, and that I certainly get that from my peers.
No, that's, yes. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. That was a really good question. Joe, do we have another? I think we have one more question in the queue.
Right. As a reminder, if you'd like to ask a question, please press *1 on your telephone keypad. Our next question is from Patricia Pagnotta from Orlando, Florida. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Dorothy.
Hi, Patricia.
Thank you so much. This is such a good presentation.
Thank you.
But I really don't have a question. I just wanted to comment when it was Jennifer that asked about, was this done in what context has this been with multiple sclerosis? And I don't know if you're aware that Brant Oliver, I believe it was back when we had the annual meeting in Washington, D.C., he had a really nice poster presentation of a educational session that he was doing with several different providers looking at bringing patients along from onset of disease, newly diagnosed, giving them information, having them work with both a case manager, a psychologist, a whole slew of different specialties that he had, physical therapist, occupational therapist, but with a course of like 8 different classes. But in that, he had embodied through all of that motivational interviewing. And then also at the same annual meeting, the VA had several presentations when they were talking about telephone interviewing, and they're trying to keep track of their patients who were spread across the country and then were going into these hubs. And so some of the psychologists, when they made presentations, brought up the motivational interviewing. That's when I first recognized motivational interviewing in multiple sclerosis, and the VA really has done an exceptional job at phone interviewing and keeping contact with patients who are spread across the, you know, different states.
Gosh, those are excellent points, Pat. Brandt did one of these town meetings.
Yes, he did. He did. Yeah. I think he did. What was it? He did
it
resources.
For resources for
right,
the psycho
right.
and psychosocial issues is
right,
what focus.
Right. So he has been an enormous contributor.
Yeah, he's
right.
really very good.
And maybe we can ask Brandt if he would be willing to revisit that poster, and perhaps we could put it on our website for the IOMSN. We could certainly, you know, see if he's willing to share some of those concepts, because you are absolutely on target. That was really an excellent presentation. You know, you just mentioned so many things that have gotten me thinking, too. The VA has done an excellent job with their centers of excellence, et cetera, but also there's so much telephone nursing going on now, whether it be the industry support lines that help our patients, of how many people. I know a nurse in the rural Pennsylvania who does most of her practice on the phone because she's doing phone calls and et cetera, and she basically doesn't see people. She's talking with them on phone. So that's an excellent, excellent point about how these skills that motivational interviewing might espouse would be really very helpful to the person who doesn't have that face-to-face contact.
Patricia, do you know if they have any type of guidelines or templates, you know, for the telephone interviewing at all? Any access to anything like that?
I don't have access to it, but I know that they had templates. They had a very they present, again, I believe this was in the meeting in D.C. They had a very defined way of, and it was all part of their research in moving into these centers of excellence. They had a very defined way of what they were going to ask. And then in asking, they had, of course, the picked topics, and then how they would get persons to give them information was based off of all of asking these questions in a way that they truly then got to the person's motivation for wanting to even be on the telephone. So they use those techniques versus, you know, you and, I mean, I don't know about you guys, but me in practice, you know, it's very hard when you've got such a limited amount of time and you've got to find out this, that, and the other. And so I try to, at least in my very last part of my HPI, ask a patient, okay, something that really I'm just going to be listening to them.
Yes.
You know, don't give me, I've got all these things I have to tell you, but now just give me something that's meaningful to you. And so
yes.
I just use that to try to engage persons in conversation and try to get to something I can put in the chart. Okay, next time when you come back,
mm-hmm.
I know that it's your three-year-old that really
sure.
motivates you, so I can ask more about your three-year-old, so that pulls back information from them. So but I don't know if they published the tool. I know they were doing research with it
that's
as far
super,
as the VA.
That's a super example, though, of how you are listing that. I mean, I usually say to people, is there something you do not want to leave this appointment without having asked or done or whatever? And I'm usually able to get them into one to three things that are really important to them about focusing on for that time that we have together. And sometimes, I want to help people. I want to help solve their problems. And you can't do that. Sometimes it's just listening. And I like to convey a sense of being positive. But not all situations are very positive. And my kids always said that I tried to put a rosy glow on things. And they'd say, Ma, if it sucks, it sucks. You know, you just, that's the reality of it. So sometimes what we're dealing with is trouble. You know, it hurts or it reminds them of what they're facing or whatever. So sometimes just listening too is part of what we're offering. And knowing that it's perfectly okay to do that, that's part of the skill set of changing, you know, of stepping away from feeling responsible for them, changing their behavior. Because we have to remember this is really a tool to help people motivate toward change and helping them realize and verbalize their own reasons for wanting to do or change or whatever. So it's really it's a change agent.
Right, true.
Thank you, Patricia. Thank you for your question.
Thank you
comments.
So much. Yeah, that was excellent. And I, for one, am going to see if I can't follow up with Branton and the VA and see if we can't pull together even more resources, because I think Lori and Jen would agree that there's lots on this topic.
Oh, there's lots of information. There's a lot of different ways that we can go. We've already talked about several different, you know, telephone interviewing just right there.
Right.
It's a huge topic.
Right.
So I think, Dottie, I think we have one more question in the queue. Joe?
Thank you. The next question is a follow-up from Jennifer Smirka. Please go ahead with your question.
Hi, Dottie.
Hey, I'm keeping you up.
I just thought maybe as we're kind of winding down, it would be helpful since we have a few minutes to just, if you wouldn't mind, you had mentioned in your talk that you had some tips.
Yes.
So maybe we could briefly review those before we close.
Okay. Well, you know, we talk about data, and the plural of anecdote is not data, et cetera. So I was looking into, intuition and why it may not be the wisest to trust your gut. And I found something just in the commercial, not necessarily medical literature, but I liked it. It was, don't trust your gut. Why our first instincts are usually wrong. So I thought, okay, what has this got to say to me? But it did speak to me. This Stephen Greenspan wrote a book called The Annals of Gullibility. And here, this is a guy who wrote about gullibility, and then he got caught in the retirement savings scam of Madoff. So, I mean, even these people make mistakes. But the list of a half dozen mistakes that we all made, one was trusting stories over statistics. And we do it all the time with I had a patient or this and that, and remembering it's an N of one versus data. And these days of evidence-based medicine, we do try to look to data. But the second mistake is this feeling of terminal uniqueness, that we or our patients are the exceptions, and that maybe they're not, that maybe looking at group things. So another mistake our gut can make is we can get caught up in the numbers and get caught up in the fine details and then sort of miss the forest for the trees, that maybe we can look at something small instead of seeing the overall big picture. And another thing is for not trusting just intuition is sometimes visuals can affect decisions, that we lose our objectivity. Another thing, and it may just be human nature, but our gut, we tend to look for information that confirms our belief. Like, see, I knew that, or looking for what we want to hear. And patients sometimes will oblige us. They want to please us. They don't want to disappoint us. So maybe they're not going to fess up their adherence issues because they don't want to disappoint us because we did such a brilliant job in training them or teaching them or we're so happy for them that they don't have the heart to tell us they're not doing it. Or the kicker and the last one for not is we've always done it that way. Sometimes, you know, we talk about helping people change, but it's hard for us to change because we've always done things a certain way. And that's why I think it's so important for new people who may be getting involved with IOMSN or wonder where is their place, and they'll see someone like me who's been around 100 years, not to realize that their contribution, your contribution, is as important, if not more, because it's the future. Maybe we've always done it that way, but maybe we can do it better. So,
Daddy,
those were my tips, but don't trust your gut.
Thank you. Thank you, Jen. Looks like we're just about out of time for this evening's discussion. Dottie, I would like to thank you. Your presentation was wonderful. Appreciate you coming on and doing this. And on behalf of the IOMSN Town Hall Discussions, I would like to also thank Biogen IDEC for supporting the programs through their unrestricted grant. And Jennifer Smirka and I hope that you'll join us next month. Diane Loudon will be presenting When the Patient is Non-Adherent, Strategies for the MS Nurse. So good evening. Thank you for all joining us. We will conclude tonight's meeting, and I hope you have a good night. Hope to see you next month.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks. This concludes the teleconference. You may disconnect your lines. Thank you for your participation.